going, stranger.
And you can dance for inspiration.
You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Desperately Seeking Susan. Joining me is Absolute Radio DJ Claire Sturgis. Hi Claire, how are you?
Hi, I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you for bringing a video that some will call an absolute cultural masterpiece.
Well, I'm really pleased you said that, because I think it is, and I'd forgotten how culturally important it was to me, certainly growing up, from sort of a feminist viewpoint as well, which it didn't really sink in at the time. But now going back and having a look and sort of reading more about it, it was just ahead of its time. And anyway, I'm sure we will discuss that as we go.
Well, as we discussed before we started recording, I think this is the first time I'd seen the movie all the way through from start to finish. And watching it now, sort of 35 years or so later on, it's very much a time capsule in the way that the movie was marketed as a Madonna vehicle, even though when the film was made, she was only still a rising star. And, you know, coming back in 2020, and even now, she's still arguably the most influential pop musician ever, certainly female-wise.
Definitely. And I also think, yes, I do, but also I think the film really, for me, always belonged to Rosanna Arquette. I thought she stole the show for me, because at the time, I remember thinking at the time, and again, I was too young to want to be them because they were so much older than me. But at the time, I identified more with her, as in, you know, I was so uncool, but I wanted to be cool. Madonna was untouchable, as was Susan. So for me, the film was all about Rosanna Arquette, and Madonna was just something that was just like, oh my God, you know, I idolized and worshipped her. But it was this blossoming, this discovering of Rosanna's character, you know, Roberta, you know, her journey across those few days, I just thought was amazing.
And I think the fact that coming back to it as, you know, older me rather than a teenager or anything like that, you can really appreciate Roberta's life and why she sought this adventure. You know, it's difficult to almost patronising to call her a bored housewife, but that's kind of what she is.
But she was. Exactly. She was a very young woman, and she was bored. She had, you know, with her husband, with Gary, selling his bathroom spas and jacuzzis, was someone who clearly looked after her. She had a nice life, but there was nothing for her to do. And yeah, I think she was bored. And it makes you wonder why she'd sort of given up, because she was clearly intelligent, and she clearly wanted other things, but it makes you wonder what her story was up to that point. Again, that's something else. You know, what did she do? How did they meet? Why was he the man for her? But then I think that was quite common back in the day, actually.
Well, probably. I mean, she looked around, I don't know, 25, 26 when the movie was made.
Yeah.
And she looked young and, dare I say it, naive.
Yeah.
And she's married to this older guy who's essentially a hot tub salesman, which I guess probably sounds better in the context of the 80s. And when you bear in mind the opening scene that she's involved in is at a party celebrating the fact that his hot tub emporium has just launched a new advert on TV, where he's seen on screen with a couple of attractive models, and she clearly looks uncomfortable at the whole thing. And her life is such that he doesn't treat her as an equal at all, really. And you can understand why she has to seek adventure in the form of the personal ads of the newspapers.
Well, exactly. And you would think any other sort of relationship, you'd be so proud of your husband. But appearing on TV and doing this advert, and again, earning the money and having this lifestyle. But you get the impression that she's seen it all before, and it's probably not as glamorous or cool as you think. I mean, there's no suggestion that he was sort of playing around, but there certainly was a suggestion that their sort of love life wasn't particularly spectacular. So, makes you wonder.
And we find through the personal ads that while she isn't the kind of regular customer, and we come on to a scene with that later on where people who perhaps are regular users of the ads, but you know, she uses them and she finds what she's looking for.
Exactly, yeah, the personal ads. I mean, that's another thing that sort of struck me about this film. I'd forgotten just how exciting personal ads used to be, because I remember them in Time Out. I mean, you're a Londoner, you remember back in the day, the Time Out ads, the small ads, were, you know, I could spend a whole week just going through those for all sorts of things, not just the you know, the meetups, but everything. It's all the small ads were fascinating. It was a whole different life. Loved it. So, yeah, totally. That brought all those memories flooding back.
And I think if some crazy person ever came along and wanted to remake the film, then they wouldn't have to do too much, really, other than evolve how they communicate through the chat. You know, whether it's an app or a website or, I don't know, Facebook or something like that, where, you know, you just need to keep that in touch and that's it.
Yeah, I think it could happen now. I think because it is... It's so different and yet it is so similar in its feeling. What I think would make it different was the fact that, of course, now you're never far away. I always know where my friends are. I always know where, you know, you're a phone call, a text, a tweet, a Facebook messenger away. You can't disappear like Susan used to disappear or like Jim used to disappear. You know, no one disappears anymore. Well, they do, but you know, in a relationship, like unless you want to be gaslit or ghosted, you know, people just don't disappear. We're far too contactable these days. And again, that's what I loved about this. You know, you could be mysterious and enigmatic and just disappear for a few months, and that was almost okay. I mean, Jim was quite happy to let Susan, you know, she's off doing her thing. I'll see her in a few months. I'll just check the small ads. So that romance, that romance of, you know, of disappearing, love it.
You see it today when people, whether they delete their social media profile or they just turn their mobile off for a little while and go off the grid. In 1985, I suppose the equivalent would just be don't answer your house phone and you're away.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Just stick on the answer phone and off you go. Yeah. The answer phone. Gosh, yeah, there you go.
And at this point, we're formally introduced to Susan. She's woken up in a Atlantic City hotel room. We meet her getting off a bus at Port Authority in the middle of New York City. And it's that really memorable piece that we see. And I know you share the picture on Twitter quite often of Madonna in a lady's bathroom drying her pits on a hand dryer. It's quite iconic.
This is my favourite movie moment. I think one of the most iconic moments in the Port Authority ladies' room. She's drying her hair and her face and her armpits and she's just sorting herself out. It just looks amazing. Everyone I know, I think at some point, has done the same thing. Maybe not the armpits, but certainly you dry your face and your hair as well as your hands on those dryers.
I do remember doing that when I was a kid after swimming at the swimming pools. My hair, maybe not my armpits. And I certainly didn't look anywhere near as cool as Susan did in that toilet.
No one looks as cool as Madonna with drying your pits in a bathroom.
I can imagine the people who do that on a daily basis now are certainly not Madonna anyway.
No.
I suppose she can get away with it being Madonna, but again, we had talked previously about perhaps these days Madonna is seen almost as completely mad, and I don't know if it's a money or just the other planet that she lives on.
I just think Madonna now, because I still think she's amazing, but I think Madonna is a person, a celebrity, a famous person who no one says no to her. Really, I mean, she does pretty much what she wants to do when she wants to do it. So it's one of those things in life where when you're surrounded by yes people, you know, you will do. And I don't think she's particularly, she's not crazy, but she just does what she wants. And she lives in this strange, surreal world of just, she has everything she could wish for. I mean, she worked so hard for what she wanted. She took so much shit back in the early days I think she just thought, well, got nothing to lose. And she's kept that mindset, I think.
And I suppose the big question everyone's probably wondering is, in your line of work, have you met Madonna?
I've never properly met her or interviewed her, but I did when I worked at Radio 1, which was would have been early 90s, when I worked as Simon Bates's broadcast assistant. I got invited to a party of hers just off Carnaby Street. And she was having a party in a club. I forget which club it would have been, just off Carnaby Street. It was down Kingley Street. And I was dancing on the dance floor with her and Terence Trent D'Arby. So that sort of ages me, doesn't it? That's my claim to fame. But no, other than that, and I didn't really officially meet her then. So no, I've never met her. And I'm pleased because, you know, friends of mine like Joe Wiley has interviewed her and she's absolutely terrifying. I mean, I'm sure she wouldn't, but I think she used to love being terrifying. She loved that. Simon Bates interviewed her on a couple of occasions and was utterly, utterly terrified of her. But she loved that. She loved that as well.
But then I suppose to us mere mortals, if the price you pay to have the success and influence that Madonna has is to be terrifying to professionals interviewing her, then that's I guess the price you'll happily pay.
And that's what she did and continues to do, I think, definitely.
And when you put Madonna in the context of the time and her contemporaries, I was chatting to my wife about it when we were watching the film, and you kind of think that perhaps really, in terms of solo artists, you're looking at maybe either Prince or Michael Jackson in that world.
Yeah.
And even though perhaps her music isn't making the mark that it used to do, she's still massively relevant. She's still involved in a lot of work, you know, supporting other artists. And, you know, most adults in the Western world would have heard her music at some point.
She might not be getting the massive number one singles or albums, but I think that is partly because her fan base is a bit older, so they're probably still buying the CDs, whereas the kids now are just streaming, aren't actually buying music. But, you know, she did those massive, it's not a massive place, but she sold out the London Palladium for, two or three weeks instead of doing a massive Wembley show, which I thought was such a good idea. Really a real intimate venue for fans to really get up close with Madonna. And masterstroke, I thought that. So yeah, she's still relevant. She is still relevant. I know people do laugh at her and go, oh, Madge is off on one, but she's still relevant. She's still doing it. She's still working with incredibly interesting people as well. She knows who to pick to produce, who to work with. And yeah, if you look at her contemporaries, I mean, I think of Live Aid. She appeared at Live Aid, didn't she? And you think, you know, she was just coming up then. She wasn't even at the top of her game then. She was certainly on the way. But and she's still there and she's still doing it. And she's still, yeah, she is amazing. But back in 1985, she had the world at her feet. And I think she was just about, when this was released, she was just about to go on her Like a Virgin tour, which was the tour, wasn't it? Where it really cemented. It's like, okay, yeah, she's here to stay.
I mean, sticking with something that I tend to do on the podcast is I normally finish the episode with the song that was number one at the time this came out in the UK. And I know I looked beforehand, but when you think about how a lot of times, certainly these days, if a film is launched with a musician in mind, there might be a number one single, or even if it's something awful like that Bryan Adams song from, was that 91, I think. But the song that this kind of launched, it was Into the Groove, where, you know, it was played in the club. And as it turns out, there were lots of clips from the film in the music video. And in the UK, and I guess that was partially an issue with release dates, is that Into the Groove was number one in the UK about a month before this came out.
And it was weird because I think, as we mentioned earlier, it was never, well, as far as I'm aware, it wasn't actually made as a vehicle for Madonna. She was just very much, you know, I think Susan Seidelman, who directed it, thought Madonna would be great for this part. But it was very much a movie, you know, on its own. As was, I mean, the stars of the show were definitely the two women, Rosanna and Madonna. But also, for me, the third star was New York City. I mean, New York City just looked amazing. Sleazy, but glamorous and rough and edgy and fantastic. Just, yeah.
I mean, I've been to New York a couple of times years ago, and even now, you know, where they've gone in the movie, they're memorable places. There's Port Authority, Times Square, Battery Park. It all really sticks out. And even now, when you watch it, you can look at it and think, well, you know, the scene where Des and Roberta are riding around on the scooter, and you think, well, how do they get from there to there to there? And it's like in a film that's set in London, and you wonder about the geography and how they get from A to B, and it's usually via Q.
Oh, yeah, none of it makes sense. Never try and work out, how did they do that? But what was interesting about Times Square back in 1985, and I first time I went to New York was 1990, so it was just sort of recovering or just coming out of, well, the city almost went bankrupt in the 70s. So the 80s was very much, you know, trying to bring it back up again. 1985 Times Square was not a safe place for anyone to go at any time of the day or night. I mean, especially not at night, but even during the day, you just didn't walk through Times Square at all. Now, of course, it's very much like Leicester Square. There's, you know, movies and you know, shows, and it's absolutely fine. Back in the day, well, it's just as well they were on a bike, because, you know, you wouldn't have had a little stroll through Times Square, because it was it didn't take your life in your hands, but you certainly would say goodbye to your wallet, as my friend did. He got mugged. Just, you know, give me your wallet. Okay. So yeah.
Well, I can sympathise with that. In 2007, outside Madison Square Garden, someone pulled a knife on me and asked for my wallet.
Well, that's just rude. That's just, how very dare they?
Well, I was on my way in to watch a basketball game, so I probably looked like a complete and utter tourist. And he hadn't even put that much thought into it either, because all it was a rusty old bread knife. And I saw that and I thought, I'm just going to run away that way.
Wow.
So talking about Roberta again, the way that she seeks the adventure and finding Susan after seeing the personal ad is that she goes to the location, she follows her, it's all very sort of covert. She goes into the shop where Susan has to sell the jacket, this really distinctive pyramid jacket, and Susan goes in afterwards and buys it. And of course, she takes it home, and it's all very out of character for her. But the way that she becomes Susan is sort of on the second time of asking. She gets amnesia and bumps her head, and it's very much like something out of a daytime soap opera. And yet, you know, even looking at this now, it kind of think, well, they just about make it work, despite how sort of convoluted and slightly far-fetched it is.
It works, though, doesn't it? Because obviously she's clueless. She has no memory. She doesn't know who she is or where she's going or what she's doing. So she meets Des, purely, you know, luckily by chance, because she's wearing the right clothing. And he's obviously is very much, his defences are up, because he's been warned that Susan's a bit of a, like, you know, be careful. So he doesn't believe anything she says, which is, again, brilliant. So, you know, they have this instant chemistry in a way, but they're both sort of dancing around each other. So, yeah, look, but you're right. It's almost like, oh, God, that's an easy way out. But no, it worked perfectly.
And the mistaken identity is compounded because Roberta is so keen to follow Susan, she's bought this jacket. So when it's pointed out that, you know, this woman is wearing this jacket, it really works. It's like a uniform of some kind.
That was I loved that scene, actually, as she's following Susan, because she gets to see her. So she follows her and follows her along this busy and bustly New York street, that, you know, this type of street you see in all the movies. And she ducks into this thrift store, this secondhand store, which was a real store, apparently. I didn't realise that. I looked this up, and it was going until, you know, a few years ago, and it had to move because of a price, a rent hike. And then apparently the whole block blew up in a gas explosion. Interesting factoid for you there. But yeah, so she sells, she sort of swaps this jacket for these amazing boots. And Roberta, of course, goes in and says, I'll have that jacket. And basically that's her fate, is that's her fate set in stone there. Just putting that jacket on seals her fate, basically. And the story begins, really, doesn't it, with her buying that jacket. If she hadn't have bought that, it wouldn't have happened.
And in between this, we've got the section where Susan goes back to the shop to get the jacket back. And she leaves, because it's been sold to Roberta, she leaves her number there with the store clerk. And as Gary, who's Roberta's husband, he's piecing these pieces together. He goes back to the shop to try and trace his wife, and he gets in touch with Susan, and that very much brings them two together.
Well, exactly. But just imagine, of course, what we didn't mention, of course, in that jacket that Susan has swapped for her boots is the key with all her, with her life in, you know, the bag, her case, her clothes, her everything she has in her world is in that locker in the Port Authority station. So she needs that jacket back, and she needs that key. The key that's in the pocket of the jacket that now Roberta is wearing. So she leaves the note, and Roberta's husband. So, yeah, it's great. I mean, I think as a plot device, again, genius. Great writing.
And one little extra thing I loved about that scene was, have you seen Breaking Bad?
Yes.
Well, the street vendor with the hat that Roberta almost stole was Gus Fring.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. No way. Wow.
And I mean, we'd previously seen him on the podcast. He was Eddie Murphy's cellmate in Trading Places before he went on to big things with Do the Right Thing and movies like that.
Wow. Okay. That's a really good pub quiz question, actually. I'll make a note of that. It's really good.
And conveniently just there to rescue Roberta after she's had her bump on the head, it's Des, who's Jim's friend, and Jim is the, I don't know, is it too square to give him the label of boyfriend, girlfriend to Jim and Susan, but he's there and takes her back to his very spacious New York place, and he looks like he's got a very cool job as a cinema projectionist, which always looks glamorous.
That is a nice apartment for someone who's just a projectionist at a local indie cinema on Bleecker Street. You think, that's a nice apartment you got there, sir. Even though it's empty because his ex-girlfriend has cleaned him out. It's a very nice apartment.
And he also has a part-time job as a Deliveroo driver dropping off noodles.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And very conveniently at this meetup, Susan is taken out of the picture by being arrested and taken to jail for not paying her cab fare. And yes, it's convenient, but it's amusing that it demonstrates, as we see throughout the film, Susan's not someone who likes to pay her way through life.
Do you know what, Rich? I know people that, I've known people like that. You know, why pay when someone else will be? Yes, you know, and sure. I know, I've known women and men like that throughout the years who, you know, and they do it because they have charm and charisma, and people like Jim and Des fall for it. And, you know, so, yeah, why should I pay? But then sometimes, of course, it comes back and bites you on the arse. And this cab driver wasn't having that. Calls the cops on her, definitely.
I'd very much put myself in the Jim or Des charisma stakes here rather than Madonna, but I don't think I'd be able to get away with anything like that. But yeah, she certainly looks like she's jailed before. She's not scared or anything about the system.
She knew the score. She knew what she had to do. Yeah, yeah. Part of the job.
One thing I forgot to mention earlier was Mark Blum, the actor who played Gary, the legendary hot tub salesman. I had more memories of him from being the sort of sleazy boyfriend in Crocodile Dundee, came out a year after this.
Oh, God, of course, yes.
And he died in March of 2020 from COVID, actually.
And that was back in March, wasn't it? It wasn't long ago, was it? Yeah.
And you could see after he passed away, and using Twitter as a barometer again, the people kind of remembering him, about half were from his role in Crocodile Dundee and half were for his role as Gary in this.
Oh, I see. Right. OK. Definitely from the Desperately Seeking Susan camp.
Now, there's a scene where he is trying to report Roberta as missing because she hasn't come home because of her amnesia. And he's talking to his sister, who's played by Laurie Metcalf, who was Roseanne's sister, I think, in that show.
Yeah, she was great, wasn't she? I think that was a great, I mean, not a huge character, but again, really important just so we could really understand what Gary was about. And also, you know, from his sister, of course, we could work out what their relationship was really like, because she didn't mince her words. So we knew straight away that, you know, things weren't good because, you know.
And she was really grilling Gary with all these personal questions about his and Roberta's sex life and all these things that, I mean, I don't have sisters, I have brothers, and we certainly don't talk like that.
Yeah, she wanted to know a lot, didn't she? Do you remember when he found the diary and she, well, you know, when Susan found Rosanna's diary, Roberta's diary, and I mean, she couldn't wait to get her hands on that, what she said about me. So, yeah, she, again, she just wanted nosy. I don't know. She certainly, actually, yeah. And also her husband, well, no, not her husband, Stephen Wright played her husband or, no, boyfriend. He was great as well.
And again, like, he's an Ava who's, you know, a lot of people know him from, say, Reservoir Dogs, but in the UK he's not as big a name as he is in the US, where he's, you know, he's quite a very popular figure.
But that voice, his voice, I think, would be very familiar, even if his stand-up or his comedy routine, the voice was incredible. And so, yeah, a lot of these interesting cameos, actually, again, were fascinating, but again, all associated with sort of iconic and legendary New York people and places. And again, there's that love letter to what New York was all about in the 80s.
I suppose it's a lot more authentic than certain things you'd see now. I think if you watch something like, I don't know, I'll use Notting Hill as an example again, that really isn't the real London, I suppose, unless you live there.
Oh, for sure, definitely. I could... And again, I don't know if you thought when you watched it again, I could smell New York. I could smell the, you know, the food stalls that you were walking by. You could smell the sort of the, it was muggy, it was warm, it was just, I loved it.
And at this point, Roberta and Des are starting to bond. They're having a very romantic evening on the rooftop with noodles and saxophones playing, and there's the part, I think it's the morning after, where Roberta's putting on Susan's clothes because they've got her bag from the locker, and Des has a cheeky little perv.
A little bit saucy, wasn't it, Rich? A little bit saucy.
There was a little bit more nudity than I remembered, but I think when they classified the film, the BBFC said that it described it as brief breast nudity, if that sells the film to anyone else.
Exactly. I don't remember any of that nudity at all, but there was a little bit, wasn't there? A little bit of Des's butt as well. I was just like, oh, hello.
Something for the girls.
Mm.
Now, one sort of location in the film that pops up increasingly and at the climax of the movie is the Magic Club that was filmed in Harlem, where near where they filmed the movie Malcolm X. And it's hard to imagine any kind of destination night out venue where magic is the main sell anywhere in a big city. I mean, it's like a cross between a really bad cabaret act and somewhere where really low rent gangster mobster types hang out.
Yeah, really quite sleazy. But it's the sort of club that I really wanted to go to. That would have been amazing. Have a dirty martini and watch a bit of crap magic. Just, yeah, that'd be my kind of night out. I would love that. They just don't exist anymore.
It was also nice to see a younger John Turturro pop up as the, I don't know, the compere, the owner, the manager.
Oh, yeah, he's great, isn't he? Wow, he's always good.
And Roberta sees a help wanted sign in the window. She goes in, she becomes the magician's assistant. And they like her because she's attractive. And this is like the world's worst magic show, where she ends up looking after these doves that are like cast offs from an old butlin's holiday.
And then she's given the doves to take home and practice with. So, you know, she's landed with doves in a cage as basically a handbag for the next sort of, you know, day and night. Perfect. Again, iconic imagery. Love it.
And in the other club, you've got Gary, who's tracked Susan down because she left her number at the shop. He's gone to this nightclub to make contact with her. And they just happen to be playing Into the Groove. But he's so far out of his comfort zone because this is a place where there's no hot tubs for sale.
Yeah, how did you know?
Wild guess. She split on you, huh?
Yeah, 2 days ago.
Well, has she ever split on you before?
Oh, no, of course not.
She into drugs?
Drugs? Roberta? She's never smoked a joint in her whole life. She's probably the straightest person in Fort Lee.
Uh-huh.
Look, what are you driving at?
Well, yeah, of course. And what a great song. But that was filmed at Dansetera, which was the club that Madonna first appeared at when she did her first ever live performance in that club. So I would imagine that she was very keen to have that club featured. I'd like to think that she played a part in including that. And I would imagine that most of the people we saw in that club were probably Dansetera sort of club regulars. I'd love to think that was the case. And that club didn't last for much longer, I think, at that venue, just a few more years. And then I think either moved somewhere else and then eventually shut down. I think that really did sum up sort of the punk, goth, new romantic element of the city. Very much so.
It was definitely a very broad mix of punters in there. It's a lot more diverse than you'd think, and probably very different from how New York City is often portrayed.
Yeah, definitely. And it was very much a representation of what was happening in New York at the time, very much so. You know, these people were there and they were in these clubs. They were clubbing at midnight and going home at 7 a.m. And the club life in New York was just iconic. Most things in New York were just iconic. So it's really pleased that you know, Susan Seidelman decided to include that club in the film. It's good.
I suppose it's difficult for me to say, not having been in that world, but if you're someone like Madonna and you've had these sort of contacts and people that you've worked with in the past, and even if this isn't your movie, something I actually found researching was the front cover of the video release of this, where in inverted commas at the top of the video said "That Madonna movie, the New York Times."
Oh, really?
And you couldn't tell whether it was being sarcastic or not.
Oh.
But yeah, even Madonna as this rising star must have had some influence or some say on having that particular venue involved in the movie. You know, it's obviously special to her in some way.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I would love to interview the director, Susan Seidelman, because she also would go. She's done a few films, but no real famous, anything sort of as famous as Desperately Seeking Susan. However, she did direct a handful of episodes of Sex and the City, including the pilot episode. And again, if you go back now and watch the pilot episode of Sex and the City, as far as New York is portrayed in that, it's very similar. It's all about her love for New York. It's very similar, but obviously in the 90s as opposed to the 80s. So
I guess if you've got an eye for that thing, then you're going to include it. I haven't seen a huge amount of Sex and the City, but you know, even from the limited amount I've seen, you know, a huge part of it is the scenery, the settings, the locations.
Absolutely, yeah. It was very much about these four women and their interconnecting lives, but it was because it was in New York. It couldn't have happened anywhere else. Just like Desperately Seeking Susan, I don't think could have happened. You couldn't do it in LA. LA isn't close enough, it's too spread out. It could only have happened in New York, I think, Desperately Seeking Susan, definitely.
But it helps having a location like that where there is a more, I guess, international appeal, where, you know, I'd struggle to name enough places in Los Angeles, for example, but you can watch somewhere in New York, I think, and recognise it a bit easier, in the way that you'd hope if sort of people not from the UK would recognise parts of London. But yeah, I mean, I think New York would be the obvious place for it.
Yeah, that doesn't work. Can't do that, mate.
I don't know. I'd quite happily say one where, oh, this one's a bit of a love letter to Camden.
I'd watch that. Yeah, definitely.
And while Roberta, in Susan's clothing, is sort of finished working at the Magic Club, she's accosted by this Wayne. I think it's like a private detective or someone who's trying to retrieve these Egyptian earrings that she's got for the reward.
So, see, he's certainly a bad guy, isn't he? I mean, he obviously wants them, I think, for whatever. I mean, he clearly killed the guy in Atlanta or pushed him out of the window, therefore killing him. But I imagine he worked for some higher up mob boss who probably wanted these earrings. But yeah, he wasn't a nice man. Don't like him. Keep your hands off Roberta.
And at one point, he's sort of chasing her down these alleyways, and he actually pulls his gun and holds it to her head. And as we all know from the history of film and TV, if you've had amnesia and after bumping your head, the way to cure it is to bump your head again. And this is exactly what happens here.
Absolutely. That's the law in the movies. Just bang your head again and everything will go back to normal.
But the ever-friendly police come across her and assume that she's a prostitute, so take her to prison.
And he was the pimp, yeah.
And while all this is happening, Gary and Susan have bonded, and Susan's gone back to their house, and she's very much making the most of the facilities. She's using their bathtub, they're smoking drugs together, and then the next morning she's out by his pool. It's all very cosy.
That's another iconic moment for me, actually, Rich, when she's laying on the sun lounger outside by the pool. So she's swimming in the pool in what looks like Gary's wife fronts. I'm sure they're not. And then she's on the sun lounger with her cheesy Watsits next to her, a couple of bottles of red, a massive phone and some cassettes. I thought that's the 80s wrapped up in a tabletop right there. Fantastic.
Just little scenes like that that remind you of better times.
Yeah, exactly.
And I suppose you have the unfortunate timing where Roberta calls Gary on the house phone to get him to come and pick her up. And Susan answers the phone. So, of course, I guess if, you know, you think, oh, he's got another woman in already or whatever. And it just so happens that Des comes along and picks her up because he's a gentleman and they love each other, really. They're soulmates, despite him thinking she's someone else.
She's actually finally met a man who actually is quite nice and actually will talk to her, not at her.
I mean, he treats her nice, even though she's clearly mysterious enough to be banned from the local Greasy Spoon. I can't imagine how that feels, because normally when I go to the cafe and order a set breakfast, I usually pay.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best thing to do, really, isn't it?
And it's while Susan is lounging by the pool, she turns on and sees that these earrings haven't been found yet and these guys are arrested for smuggling, that she decides she needs to communicate with this stranger in order to get these earrings back. And she goes and sets up this personal ad down at, well, I mean, you said Time Out. I remember him from Loot. And you've got all sorts of characters in there. It's you've got the one older guy who's in there looking for a bit of afternoon fun or afternoon delight.
I know. God, you mentioned Loot. Of course, Loot. Wow. Well, another interesting thing. Did you notice when Susan walks into the newspaper to place that small ad, she walks by the triplets who give her a very admiring look. And those triplets, again, that was a cameo appearance for those three lads who about 3 or 4 years previously had been reunited. So they were quite famous in New York at the time. There were triplets who had been separated at birth as part of an experiment, a scientific experiment. And they'd met again purely by chance, and the press had picked up on it, and they'd become these celebrities because of it. So that's why they featured as a cameo in Desperately Seeking Susan, I think, at Madonna's request. And I watched a documentary on them about 3 months ago. It's a fascinating story. So on aside from this, check out the story about the triplets. It's very bittersweet. I can't remember the names off the top of my head, but I'll let you know. It's you would not believe it, but it's true.
And you've got Roberta in bed with Des. Jim comes along. They see the ad for the personal ad for the stranger and where the earrings are going to be. And this is where it all kind of ends up, heading towards the magic club again.
Exactly.
And this is where it becomes like a cross between a caper and a farce. It's like something like Fawlty Towers, where all these different little things are going on at the same time. It's all very confusing.
I thought the same thing, actually. I'd forgotten, as you mentioned, that I'd forgotten how towards the end it does turn into a bit of a farcical comedy. Everyone running around, missing them, missing that, you know, not quite seeing who's where, and they're all in the same place. Yeah. But it works, but it's not in a naff way. It works.
Because you've got Jim thinks that Susan is Susan, Des thinking that Roberta is Susan, and at the same time, Gary, his sister, the boyfriend, have turned up with the real Susan, and they're sitting down expecting some rubbish cabaret, and they're not expecting to see Gary's wife on stage as the very much 1985's Debbie McGee.
Doing a great job as well. Not.
It's just a very weird kind of conclusion when you think about the film has had, it's had a lot of funny moments, you know, little bits of slapstick here and there and that. And it's just a very unusual way to end this kind of film where, you know, it's actually not, it doesn't go on to silly. I mean, it's not like you're watching an episode of Bottom or anything like that, but it definitely takes a very comedic turn.
Yeah, there's no element of like keeping us guessing at that point. We kind of, well, we certainly hope we know what's going to happen, and there are no surprises. It's as we want it to happen, and the way they get there is very straightforward. But it's so endearing. We forgive them for the slight sort of farcical comedy element to it. Well, I certainly do. I certainly do. Because of Madonna, because she's cool.
We get Susan and Jim reunited on top of, I think it's a pinball machine, and they get a gun to the head from the mysterious Wayne. And the earrings are stolen from Roberta while she's in the box about to get chopped in half as part of the magic show. Just for note, it's not real. And we get the reuniting of Gary, Hot Tub Man, and Roberta. And, of course, she's gone through this magical adventure where she's gone from Roberta to Susan and back again. And it kind of shows the difference and Gary's viewpoint, because one of the first things he asks her about her sort of out-of-character behaviour is, are you a lesbian? Gary seems genuinely confused. She must be a lesbian, because how could she not want to be Mrs. Hot Tub?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so that sort of sums him up, doesn't it? Well, it can't be me, so it must be you. You must be a lesbian if you don't want to be with me.
Oh, imagine having that much of an ego.
Yeah, there's plenty of them out there.
And then Gary, again, you know, the alpha man that he thinks he is, gives Roberta the ultimatum of saying, well, if you're not in the car in 5 minutes, I'm going home without you. It's not really an offer that she can't refuse, is it?
Yeah, so clearly he'd go home alone.
It just doesn't sound like much of an ultimatum. It's basically, do you want to go home in 5 minutes, make a decision that, do you want to go home and be treated like the help and really go back to this life that you've dreamt about escaping from? Or do you want to go to Des, who, yeah, maybe he's not as rich and he's not as well off, but, you know, he seems pretty cool and he actually genuinely seems to like you.
Yeah. Seems normal, cool, warm, friendly, funny. All she needs.
And we finally get Roberta and Susan meeting. Roberta rescues Susan from the evil clutches of Wayne. But this is seems to be a recurring theme. I've had it on a few films recently where the main build actors of the film don't meet until the very end. And it's quite interesting when that happens.
Well, exactly. So that was literally their only screen time together, apart from when they're walking along the street following each other. Well, Roberta's following Susan. So, yeah, so, you know, they're the two main stars. Actually, good point, Rich. I hadn't thought. And this is the first time they share any screen time. Wow. I wonder if they even liked each other or got on. I'm sure they did. But
Well, maybe one day they can make Desperately Seeking Susan 2 and they can pretend to be someone else. But, you know, the main climax of the film is, you know, Roberta goes off with Des, they live happily ever after, and they return the earrings, presumably to a reward, if I remember.
They get an award from the mayor or something, don't they? And it's all lovely.
It's a nice little ending. And I think the way that, you know, we've seen that the two main characters, Roberta and Susan, have these very different lives, but, you know, they probably do get on. And it'll be interesting to see, and I'm not proposing a sequel in any way, but I'd be interested to see where Susan's life turns after this. I mean, does she even start paying for things?
I would have loved a follow-up. But then, no, I think it's a perfect piece of cinema as it stands. I love a happy ending. I loved the location. I loved, like, Bleecker Street Cinema, which, you know, existed up until a few years ago. And, you know, one of New York's sort of little small indie cinemas showing independent films. Sadly, that's no longer there anymore. But, and again, a love letter to, you know, in small independent films, which I think was very important for Susan Seidelman to include in this, just like it was having, you know, the clubs as well and the little magic club. All these little places, so important. So yeah, it was it's a perfect little snapshot of New York in the mid 80s with someone who would go on to be a massive, possibly one of the biggest female pop stars in the world ever. But it wasn't her movie. And I think that was so, I think they balanced it so well. It wasn't just about her. It was mainly about Rosanna and her Roberta character.
And as you say, I mean, Rosanna Arquette was very much the main lead of the film. But it was interesting as well that this, and I read this from IMDb, charted the rise of Madonna in the fact that when the movie started shooting, I think, or just afterwards, Like a Prayer or Like a Virgin came out. And by the time the film had finished shooting, they needed security on set to keep her away from being mobbed.
Right, probably Like a Virgin, I would imagine, yeah. I would have liked to have thought I would have watched the movie if it hadn't have been Madonna, but certainly it was brought to my attention because of Madonna. That's what made me want to watch it, without doubt. Absolute masterstroke, having her in it, definitely.
And I think with the benefit of hindsight, and even now being generous, I you know, she was a very young woman at the time. She was on her way up in the world of music. I don't think anyone would have probably put her in the category of a Golden Globe winner for acting.
No, and again, I read somewhere, there was an interview with the director saying that she, you know, Madonna was just acting as Madonna. She wasn't acting, she was being herself, which is why it's so good and why she's so convincing and why you believe her. At no point did I went, oh God, that's terrible acting, because she wasn't acting. She was being Madonna. It was a role made for her, really. I just think this role, she was good as Evita as well, actually, give her that. She was good in Evita. But, you know, whatever she's in, she has to be Madonna. Or nothing. And this was perfect. Yeah.
Well, that was Desperately Seeking Susan. And I think, you know, the story has aged pretty well. And as we discussed earlier, I think you wouldn't need to make too many tweaks. I'll never advocate remaking a film for the sake of it. But I think this has aged remarkably well.
It's a great story. It is a great story. I still think that they would have problems trying to work out the way that it was so difficult to get hold of people. You know, they kept missing each other. Couldn't get hold of Susan, couldn't get hold of Roberta, couldn't get hold of Gary, couldn't find... It was so hard to get hold of people. And I think you wouldn't have that as a problem today, really, unless, of course, you didn't have your mobile phone with you. But I mean, I'm sure someone could have a workaround for that. But
maybe if the mad bastard stopped burning 5G masts, then that might be a plot point.
There you go. But I think as a movie, it was just a perfect. And I'm so pleased I watched it again, because it'd been so many years since I watched it. A perfect snapshot of mid-80s New York. Love the story, love the characters. Gotta say though, Rich, for me, New York is the absolute star because I love that city so much. And it's so different now. Much like, I mean, you're a Londoner, you know, you've been here all your life. So you know, like what Soho was like in the early 80s, early 90s. And again, could be deeply unpleasant for many people, but it was also glamorous and sleazy and edgy and beautiful. And it was amazing.
Well, Claire, again, thank you very much. And we best return that Madonna movie to the video shop before we get charged any late fees. Now, as you discussed, you're often heard on Absolute Radio. So where can people find you and what can we expect from your shows?
Well, you'll hear me every Friday night for Absolute 80s, of course. So every Friday, I play all the greatest hits of the 80s. And then on the Saturday, if you like a bit of classic rock, a little bit of yacht rock, a little bit of punk rock, a little bit of grunge, I'm there every Saturday night for a bit of a rock party. And then I do the request show on a Sunday. I pop up on Absolute Radio at the weekends.
And is there a lot of Madonna on your playlists?
On Absolute 80s, yes. Not on the Absolute Radio main station. She's not really one of our target artists. We play more sort of guitar-based music, but definitely on Absolute 80s, you'll hear Madonna, definitely, yeah.
And I'll be honest, and this isn't being biased at all because you're a guest, in our house and in the car, Absolute 80s is pretty much always on because, well, you've got to stay on brand and the 80s just had great music.
Well, I thank you for that. Yes. No, I love a bit of 80s. I mean, do you know what? I love all the decades. I love all the decades, mate. But 80s, I think, is a safe place to be. Music wise, definitely. Yeah. And the 80s, let's not forget, the 80s were people were experimental, breaking new grounds. Genres were being born. Everything happened in the 80s. I know a little bit happened in the 90s. You had punk in the 70s, but a lot of stuff happened in the 80s.
And what other decade could you start with ABBA and end in? Ooh, I don't know.
Iron Maiden. ABBA to Iron Maiden. They're all there, yeah. I mean, yeah, they're all there. And I think the 80s taught me that you didn't have to be part of just one tribe. You could be part of several.
Or if you're thinking about another 80s song, maybe Two Tribes?
Wait, there you go. Nice. Good work. Yeah. Good work. Good work.
Well, as is tradition on the podcast, we always play out the episode with the song that was number one in the UK at the time of the film's release. Now, as we discussed earlier, Into the Groove was number one just beforehand. But when this film came out, it was the 6th of September 1985, and the number one song was I Got You, Babe by UB40 and Chrissie Hynde. Now, we've played that, I think, at least three times on this podcast, so let's do something different. Now, if you waited a couple of days, you didn't see it on the day it came out, the number one song was Dancing in the Street by Mick Jagger and David Bowie. So
I think that's a great song to end the podcast on. And just imagine the two of them dancing together. David Bowie looking incredibly cool and Mick Jagger clearly hating it because he clearly doesn't have David Bowie's moves, even though it's moves like Jagger. Not in this case, mate.
And this doesn't work on the podcast, but if you get a chance, and I'll put a link in the show notes, find the video of them doing the song without music. It's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. It's hilarious. Please watch it.
Well, Claire, thank you very much again.
Thank you, mate. Always a pleasure. Love that film. Love talking about it.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, and Alan Fewings, and associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise, and more.